Podo.
Bim bom bim bom, bim bom bim bom, bim bom bim bom, bim bom bim bom.
It's been a long time, but we're back.
Who are you again?
I'm Joe Twyman, and I'm the co-founder of the public opinion consultancy Delta Poll. But who are you?
I think I'm Marie LeConte, freelance journalist, etc. But I'm not sure at this stage.
Didn't we used to do a podcast?
I think we did. I think, yeah. It had a bit of a rubbish name though, didn't it?
It did. Yeah. So if we were going to do it again, and obviously since we did that podcast, many of the guests we've spoken to have gone on to their own moderately successful podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, like that Sex Pistols gig in Manchester, about seven people went to watch it, but all of them went to form their own punk band.
Yeah, and it's similar here. Certainly, if you'd asked me, of all the guests, which was the most charismatic and outgoing broadcast-ready person to do a podcast, perhaps I wouldn't have selected who went on to be successful, but, you know, that's just the way these things work.
That's showbiz, baby.
And so here we are for The Polling Station.
It's a much better name.
How have you been, Marie?
I have been okay, thank you. I did not think there would be an election over the summer, which actually I'm quite annoyed about because I spent a lot of time late last year and earlier this year saying, actually, a late June election would be really fun and fragrant. That was my thing, fun and fragrant election. And then, you see, everyone called me an idiot, so eventually I stopped. And turns out I was right. I was right. We're having a fun and fragrant election. Although it doesn't especially feel, I would say, fun and fragrant at the moment, partly because the weather is really bad and also partly because it's just been a bit boring. But I don't know. Have you been? How's your election going?
Well, I for some time had suggested that November the 21st was strategically the best date for the election.
But you still had the US election during the campaign, though, which would not have been great, I think. I mean, to be clear, Rishi had to pick between, like, no choice was good there, but still.
Yes, I agree, but I stand by the idea that it would have been better than holding it in July. But then, given what we've seen, I think it would have been difficult. Anyway, and so confident that there would not be an election before the summer, I went ahead and booked my three-week holiday that's now going to be spent talking to you. Well, welcome to the polling station. Over the next 4 weeks in the run-up to election day, we are going to discuss all things polling. Who's up, who's down, who's in, who's out, and what do the numbers really mean? We're going to take an in-depth view at a particular constituency every week, and we're going to speculate about where we might be come 4th of July.
But yeah, so I guess to begin with, like, what's the story been like so far in terms of the polling? So I do feel like actually it's really been a very polling-heavy election, perhaps because actually not much is happening elsewhere. But, you know, there's been a lot of Twitter kind of like, it's been really funny, I think, like pollsters kind of behaving like rock stars and you're like, ooh, like I've got a sexy little thing dropping in about 2 or 3 hours, honeys. And it's a bit like, it's just going to say the same thing, presumably, that every other poll will. But yeah, so how have you found it so far?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of sort of telegraphing things like that. I can think it can be a bit of fun, but ultimately, most of the polls have not shown much change. And so broadcasting, you have a poll coming out to then show no change is not particularly exciting. When there has been a change, it tends to be an outlier. And as we know, Marie, you shouldn't focus on the outliers. But the story of the polling is actually a continuation of the trends that we have seen for a long time. You have to go back to December 2021 for the last time the Conservatives were ahead in any published poll.
Oof.
And Labour have had a double-digit lead in every published poll since September 2022. So going into this election, in terms of the long-term trend, it did not look good. And Conservatives talk about the fact that, oh, well, things only went bad after Boris Johnson. Simply not true. Mm. When you look at the trends, this is something that set in under Boris Johnson, accelerated under Liz Truss, was then stabilised by Rishi Sunak. But the gap has now been considerable for a considerable period of time. And so the election had to take place at some stage before January. Mm. And Rishi Sunak decided, in his wisdom, that July would be it.
But so has anything at all shifted anything in the campaign? Like, has there been any point at which you've seen something go, oh, actually, you know, something happened in the world and we've seen it reflected in the data, like, for, you know, good or ill for the government?
Yeah, I mean, the big story of the polling, not just actually of the campaign, but of the entire year, really, has been the rise of Reform. Mm. And so that is something that that was trundling along nicely. And in fact, one of the reasons that it's been speculated that the election was called in July was so that the Conservatives could neutralise the threat of reform generally and Nigel Farage specifically.
That's gone really well.
Yes, it's been an absolute, absolute unrivaled success. The suggestion was that he was set to announce, Farage, this is, was set to announce his candidacy for Clacton the week after the election was called, before they knew it was going to be called.
Really?
So apparently it was all set up to be announced. Oh. When it was announced, he then thought, I'm not going to do it, because that his concern was that if he went for it, he really had to win.
Yeah.
He couldn't be seen to lose yet again in any constituency, because that would be an eighth time. And apparently the eighth loss, that's just a step too far. But the seven previous ones, that's
fine.
Okay.
That's nothing. But I found it's actually the only argument I found so far in favour of, you know, it was a stupid idea to call it in July as opposed to later in the year, is that the thinking is that Farage actually probably kind of wants to go to the US for the election and wants to do some, like, Trumpy related stuff. So actually saying, you know, if they'd call the election later on, so in, you know, October, November, December, etc., Farage would have been in the US palling it up with some of the worst people alive. So would not have been as present, or, you know, Richard Tice, bless his heart, would have still been Reform leader, and he obviously doesn't have the charisma and the kind of appeal that Farage does, but I don't know.
Well, certainly since Farage's return, there has been an uptick in Reform's performance. In fact, we've had one poll just in the last 24 hours showing a crossover point, which apparently is now a term, where Reform pulled ahead, admittedly just by one percentage point, pulled ahead of the Conservatives to go into second place. Now, that is obviously psychologically a big deal, even if statistically they're both within the margin of error, so you can't say which one is ahead. And also, it's not good practice to focus on the outlier. And if you look at the broader trends from other pollsters, the gap is larger.
Hasn't it happened before as well? I seem to remember that in 2010, I think there were some polls where Labour ended up, that is the party of government, ended up coming third in polls. So it's not, I feel like the way people are talking about it, it's like it's literally never happened in the history of the world. But it is a thing, especially I think at the tail end of a very, very long government. It can happen that at some point in the campaign, actually the government will pull as the third party.
Well, certainly Clegmania in 2010 had an impact.
We were so young, we were so beautiful and so innocent.
Yeah, the last time a TV debate actually had an impact. But it can happen, but it is vanishingly rare. And an illustration, to my mind, of just how promiscuous people are with their voting nowadays.
Mm. So we've talked a bit about, you know, the stuff that's kind of shifted the polls a bit. Coming back briefly to the bits that may have actually changed the polls a bit. So we know that kind of, like, qualitatively speaking, God, one of my least favourite words in the English language, through focus groups and vox pops and stuff, we know that people actually seem to really care about the fact that Rishi Sunak had left the D-Day commemoration early. Like, is that something that you ended up seeing in the kind of data, or did it not really make a dent at this stage?
Yeah, certainly in our data, it suggests there was a small movement. I think the reason is sort of complicated. Ultimately, there's the strategic error of thinking, hey, a photo call with the royal family, world leaders and World War II veterans. Why would I want to do that? But for me, it was more the momentum that came out of that. And politics is so often, as we've talked about before, it's about broad narratives, the stories that we tell ourselves and each other. And what this particular incident did was enforce the idea in people's minds, in a lot of cases, that Rishi Sunak is just not very good at making decisions, that he is not particularly competent. And that's what it spoke to, more than specifically the event itself. In the same way that when Theresa May stood up and said nothing has changed, it really had, because people thought, well, actually, what is she thinking? Where is this? Government going? Can it be trusted to make the right decisions? Now, obviously, at that time, Theresa May was well ahead in the polls, but her gap closed, whereas Rishi Sunak is seeing the gap between Conservative and Labour, if anything, grow during the campaign. And that's what many of us, and indeed what by historical standards, you would expect not to happen.
That was actually a really interesting thing, I think, like on the run-up to the election being called, people going, oh, well, you know, the polls will narrow. And there were only very few voices, I think, at the time saying, well, I mean, sure, like, you know, in previous elections, like, polls have tended to narrow, but why is everyone saying that? Like, it's a thing that will definitely happen. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe we've seen that at all looking again, because I do think it can't be easy in his slight defence to be Rishi Sunak at the moment, because it feels like this campaign feels like a zero-sum game where you've got kind of like the Lib Dems and Labour and Reform kind of eating away at the Tory vote on every kind of side. So looking at the kind of polling, like, is there a direction they can take? You know, like, if you were Rishi Sunak kind of tomorrow, would you go after Tory to Labour switchers, Tory to Reform switchers, Tory to Lib Dem, knowing again that actually it's probably quite hard to find some magical message or thing that will bring back all three or two out of the three back to you? Like, what direction should they be kind of headed into?
Well, my sense is that really all year their strategy has been to appeal to the people who are now moving to Reform. Mm. And that has been the difficulty. The announcements around things like national service or national citizenship service, however you want to characterise it, so-called Mickey Mouse degrees, that sort of thing, strikes me that's all the politics of nostalgia and aimed at older voters, their core. Mm. The problem is the politics of nostalgia just isn't as good as it used to be. And now, with an insurgent party on the right presenting, frankly, simple solutions to these things, it can be very seductive, particularly if you are disappointed with the performance of the Conservatives over the last 14 years. And the difficulty that the Conservatives have had now for a long time is that if you're the Conservative Party, particularly if you're the Conservative government, you cannot out UKIP UKIP, you cannot out Brexit Party the Brexit Party, and you cannot out Reform.
That's just a particular pet peeve of mine, because I think it's something we've seen in France as well, because obviously, you know, like the National Front, the Rassemblement National, sorry, as it's called now, has been kind of, you know, coming second in now like two presidential elections, has been polling very well for a very long time, and very consistently what the centre and the centre-right keep doing is being like, well, if we nick some of their policies, we will eat away at their support and they will go away. Has that happened at any time over the past decade, 20 years? Like, no, it has not. And yet they're like, you know, is that, isn't it like Arrested Development thing, I think, of, you know, like everyone who tried this, you know, every single time has failed, but it may work for us. And it is amazing as someone who's French and living in England, in Britain, to kind of see it play out on both sides of the channel. And again, with exactly the same result each time. And yeah, and I'm not entirely sure what will break that spell for the Conservative Party. And, you know, even as someone, I think, pointed out on Twitter, it is quite funny that David Cameron came back into government right at the point where he could really watch, you know, what happened to his great tactic of calling the referendum so we don't talk about Europe and we see off UKIP forever.
Yeah, and it was similar with immigration. The Conservative Party really, at the back end of last year, and particularly at the start of this year, specifically talked up immigration as a way to emphasise a difference between Conservative and Labour, believing that they would benefit from that. In actual fact, in the polling, Labour were consistently ahead of the Conservatives on who would be best to deal with immigration generally, or asylum seekers, or small boats. But actually, if you just gave people the two parties as an option, the winning choice was don't know or none of the above. And into that situation that the Conservatives had created, you then get a resurgent Reform Party, who really, in the aftermath of COVID, weren't really going anywhere anytime soon.
Wasn't it because they went a bit mental on COVID as well, didn't they? In that way that I found really funny, because actually I was never like anti-lockdown or like a lunatic on that stuff. But I was definitely, I think I was sympathetic to some of the arguments saying that actually the lockdowns had lasted too long, which is stringent, etc. But crucially, what I knew at the time was that I was part of a vanishingly fucking small minority of people. Like, the Brits love rules. They love rules so much. So I think having this party, which at the time, and again, you know, we weren't talking about Brexit really anymore, etc. They were just like, well, you know that thing you all loved? We hated it. Vote for us. And is that amazingly, you know, they pulled quite poorly, I would say, around that point.
Yeah, I mean, their focus was on anti-lockdown as from an economic perspective, because that certainly, for a long time, that was Reform's focus, and actually still is for some of them. But that then got transferred to anti-lockdown from a sort of anti-establishment weird perspective around vaccines and things like that. Mm. And that was not a vote winner. But what was a vote winner, as is often the case, was a hard line, if vague, position on immigration.
Yay! Yeah, it is so depressing, because I do remember doing a series of features not long after the referendum seeing that actually for quite a long time, actually, you know, when you look at the kind of trackers of what the issues people cared about, people did kind of stop caring about immigration for quite a long time. And it's a bit like, oh, is this it? Oh, no, we're back. We're just talking about immigration a lot. Although this, I would say, as someone who covered, you know, 2015, this feels quite reheated. Like, it's a bit like a marriage that's kind of slowly failing and people are just having like the same arguments they've been having for 10 or 20 years. It's a bit like their heart's not in it. You can tell they're shouting at each other, but like, it's not, you don't really have the vigour that you had in the early arguments. I feel like immigration this election is nominally one of the big issues, but I'm not really seeing that. Like, there's no, yeah, the venom that used to be, I think, isn't really there anymore. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
The evolution of immigration was as an issue was interesting because it did fall back after Brexit. Mm. You then get COVID, which of course has an impact on immigration numbers and things like that, and people just aren't going out a lot and seeing these immigrants everywhere. Then after that, you start to feel the impact as a result of the government's changes to the rules. And then the numbers start shooting up, boosted by a sort of COVID hangover. Mm. And it looks very bad in terms of numbers.
But also, wasn't it partly because of schemes like Ukraine and Hong Kong, which people actually mostly agree with?
And then you have external factors as well to create essentially a perfect storm, which is and would be very difficult for any government to deal with. And Rwanda is seen as the solution to that and is very difficult to deliver in practical terms. And so here
is
we
it?
Are.
Oh. So I was born yesterday. I'm so sorry. Like, it's just. But so actually looking back at kind of like policies more broadly, because again, I feel like it's not really been a like very, apart from D-Day, like a massive like gaffe heavy or kind of like scandal heavy election campaign so far. So it's actually been quite, you know, based around the policies. And we obviously had the manifestos released this week. We have had 1 million debates. I will say, did I watch some of them? Yes. Did I not watch some of them? Yes, also. Will I go into detail about how many I did in fact watch and how many I did not? No, I won't. Lots of debates, lots of manifesto launches, etc. Like, does that stuff actually matter to voters? Like, does that really get through to the normal people, i.e. not us or the people currently listening to us?
Well, a couple of things to...
All of whom are very beautiful, etc. But, you know.
A couple of things to pick up on that. Firstly, historically, certainly in the most recent elections, it's estimated that around about a third of people make up their mind during the campaign. Mm. And they make up their mind on which party they're going to vote for. They also make up their mind about whether they're going to vote or not. But that decision is made during the campaign for around about a third of people, which is potentially a lot. In most cases, people's decision actually doesn't change from what they were thinking at the start of the campaign, and so they stick with it, but they're still not decided until the end.
I have briefly, I will let you continue with that, but I did a piece for Elle magazine actually on partly this, which I found really interesting. So the portion of people who decide who they vote for during a campaign are overwhelmingly women, I believe. Like, I think there's a massive gendered component to it, which I find super interesting. And crucially as well, so I think every election there's a bit of a freak out of going, you know, how will we win the female voters? When actually a woman, let's say, who's currently like 25, middle class, living in London, maybe undecided, she's really unlikely to be like, oh, having now heard all the arguments and watched all the manifesto launches, I will vote for reform. Like, they do end up falling for the kind of like parts of that, falling in the way that you think they will. But women are like massively more likely to go, I will properly make up my mind at the last minute. Women tend to be more decisive quite early on, which I found really interesting.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, not confined just to politics in that respect. True for many decisions.
Oh, yeah, isn't it like men hate saying that they don't know?
Oh, I'm not sure. That's what I did there.
Not the fun we have.
But into these campaigns, given that people make up their mind during the campaigns, some people make up their mind during the campaigns, we now have these sort of set pieces. Mm. We have this weird sort of historical artifact of the manifesto launches, and we have the debates as well. And in a sense, they're both important for the same reason, which is that they provide a focus for the campaign, and they really set the rhythm and the cadence of the campaign. We'll go along and it'll all be about, oh, well, tomorrow's debate, what's going to be covered there? Aftermath of what's happened in the debate, etc., etc. Mm. But the manifestos themselves, for instance, the actual documents, are largely meaningless. There are vanishingly few people out there who are getting a copy of every party's manifesto, reading each one from cover to cover, and then making an informed decision about which party they're going to vote for. Instead, manifestos are a bit like the set menu at a restaurant. Mm. And you go along to the restaurant and you look at the dishes and you think, well, I like some of this. Mm. And the dishes are the policies, and you might like some of the policies, but you might not like others. Mm. You can't pick and choose. You have to have the whole set menu.
Yeah.
And you may make your decision based on the set menu, but actually most people instead will take a look at the restaurant. And if the restaurant looks a bit dirty and a bit shabby and a bit tired, if the head chef is dropping things consistently, if the staff are fighting with each other, you're probably going to eat elsewhere. And that's how it works.
You're going to... I do have a serious point to make after this, but I cannot mention, if people listening haven't seen this, they really must Google it. One of my favourite manifesto launches was in the Labour one in 2010, where they did a whole, obviously, like Flash Gordon, etc., thing where they wanted to be hip and with down with the kids and really like future forward looking. They put the Labour manifesto on a USB stick. There's a tremendous picture of the cabinet at the time all holding a little USB stick, which is one of my favourites, or like dorky political pictures. I believe, yeah, there's, I'm looking at it right now. There's Peter Mandelson looking distinctly uncomfortable holding a very small USB stick that says Labour. And isn't that a delight? But no, so coming back on manifesto, I think, and that's something we're probably seeing. I get the sense with the Tory manifesto this time is what we got with the Labour manifesto in 2019, where, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour made the mistake of looking at a number of policies and going, OK, well, these are all polling quite well. No, focus groups presumably are responding quite well to those. So we're all going to put them together and surely they'll work. But actually, voters did not like that. There's, yeah, A, such a thing as offering too much of a good thing, and B, just saying that some policies are popular in isolation, you know, does not guarantee that, yeah, they will be kind of attractive as a package. And like, how do you work around that, I guess, as pollsters? So is it a case of, yeah, you have to pull everything separately, but then pull it together? Like, how? Well, so there's a question in there somewhere. You find it.
It's all about emphasising that things are complicated. And well, complicated in some ways, and actually very simple in others. And so we poll individual individual policies, but we try to explain to people that it's not about the individual policies. But that doesn't stop people reporting these individual policies are popular. And sometimes these individual policies are popular not because it's the policy itself, but because of what it represents. You can say to someone, for instance, do you support rail nationalisation? And around about three quarters of people in this country support rail nationalisation. But if you then ask them follow-up questions about, well, which aspects of nationalisation are you particularly keen on? It's not returning things to the public sector particularly. What it is they want trains to run on time, and they want prices...
How dare they?
And they want ticket prices to be lower. And so you're asking the question, do you want railways nationalised? But the question that respondents are answering is, do I want rail to improve? And that's why there can be that that misunderstanding. So things can get very complicated around that. But even if the policies are popular, it doesn't mean anything more than that. And it doesn't mean that a party will be popular. It doesn't necessarily mean that a leader will be popular. But they can help to add to a sort of cumulative momentum, to inform particular narratives around competence and around the kind of messages that these parties want to send. But if you flip things around, actually, looking at things historically... And this is true for all of the... This will be my ninth general election working as an analyst in one way or another. Yes.
Jesus Christ, why are you here? Why are you still here? What are you doing with your life?
I don't know. But in all of those previous elections and all the ones before that in the history of British polling, the party that is ahead on leadership and the party that is ahead
on economic
management...
Knew that. Do I get a star?
You do.
Thank you. Well done.
You've now reached your rank of junior pollster.
So yay!
You can have a little badge. You've got 2 stars on your 5-star McDonald's-style badge. If you're ahead on leadership and you're ahead on economic competence, you win the most seats of the general election.
Yeah.
Now, correlation, causation, et cetera, just because that happens doesn't mean it's that the way.
Wasn't that the 2015 thing of like Ed Miliband was actually, the Labour Party was doing decently in the polling, but then Ed was not, and also,
exactly. Those are the fundamentals. And there are lots of things you can do to change those fundamentals, et cetera, but ultimately, if you get those two right, historically, that's the game. And that gets you, and that gets you the most seats. And so in some ways it's very complicated, but in some ways it's actually pretty straightforward. Constituency of the week.
It's been so fun. I must simply go. So I nearly did a sort of woo at some point, but then I was like, I'm gonna see how long he goes on for. Then I'd forgotten that you have the lungs of a swimmer. So we could still be here tomorrow. But yeah, so I believe you have a constituency you'd like to talk to us about today, Joe.
That's right. Each week we're going to take a particular constituency because we think it's interesting or fun or could provide what the kids are calling a Portillo moment. I actually think this is a bit of a misnomer, because I'm old enough to remember Portillo losing his seat in 1997. Mm. And the thing about that Portillo moment was it was genuinely a surprise.
Yeah.
Whereas now Labour are doing so well and the Conservatives are doing so badly, I kind of think that on election night everything will just be, oh well, of course Surrey Heath went Labour. Whoever thought they'd hold on to that?
Yeah. In a weird way, would it not be like a Portillo moment, but a reverse one in the sense of, yeah, genuine surprise would be a Tory active winning a seat somewhere, like gaining a seat, and be like, oh. But yeah, so what is today's constituency of the week? Well, so, you know, I'm going to stand by that. I'm just going to stand by
what
it.
What is today's constituency of the week? Well, this month, we're going to be looking at northeast Somerset and Hannam.
Oh, that's one Jacob Rees-Mogg, I believe.
Yes, that's
also,
right.
Also, we're not even prepped that. I just knew that because my life is very sad.
Well, it previously was the northeast Somerset constituency, but in the boundary changes that have taken place and made everything far more complicated, we have added in a particular area, so it's now northeast Somerset and Hannam. And this is, as you say, Jacob Rees-Mogg's constituency. He won with just over 50% of the vote last time around.
Reasonable.
The reason I think it's interesting is that, firstly, the constituency boundary changes have made it slightly more conservative, less Lib Dem. Mm. But actually, it was Jacob Rees-Mogg who really benefited from a split in the Labour-Lib Dem vote last time. Mm. And I think this is an interesting constituency because, given everything that's gone on, I think it's perfectly possible that Jacob Rees-Mogg could lose his seat. But at the same time, it's also perfectly possible that he could sneak through on, let's say, 30, 35% of the vote because Labour and the Lib Dems get things muddled up and
stuff. That's really interesting, because I feel like we've been, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in future episodes, but I think tactical voting looks to be like one of the big stories of the election as well. Maybe, the face you have just made.
It's always meant to be the big story of the election.
No, but it does. Was it in 97? Famously, it did. Like, I remember how many more seats Labour got.
We can talk about this in a later episode. I think they call that foreshadowing, don't they?
No, that's not foreshadowing.
Polling station.
Yeah. That's just not what...
It's a trailer.
Okay, well, fine. Yeah. No, these are two different things. Fine. You know more about tactical polling. I know more about words. So there you go.
Fair.
1-1. But my point is more that I think in actually a lot of seats, what we've seen is, even though it's not necessarily been... You know, it's clearly not a deal between Ed Davey and Keir Starmer, etc. But there's a bit of a thing where sometimes maybe Labour is not massively campaigning in a seat the Lib Dems have a chance to gain from the Tories, and vice versa. Like, so is this not one of those seats? Are both Labour and the Lib Dems going, fuck you, like, this is mine?
Yeah, and the thing about what makes constituencies interesting is that we don't have constituency level polling for any of this. And so all of this inevitably is speculation. And what we can look at is where the Lib Dems are pushing. And they are pushing in the southwest. They're trying to pick up a lot of the seats they lost in 2015 when David Cameron, against expectations really, came along and swept up so many of those Lib Dem seats.
Yeah.
This was
the yellow belt.
The yellow boot almost. Mm. This was not one of those seats, because this has been consistently conservative. But if the Lib Dems are going to win a lot of seats there, there are easier ones to go for. But I think this is a sort of stretch goal, if you like, for the Lib Dems. And I imagine as a result, Labour will sort of sit back, because all the parties have finite resources and they're probably thinking there's easier seats for us to win in other areas of the country.
That makes sense. Is there, like, there's a bit of a symbolic thing as well. Like, Jacob Rees-Mogg is definitely one of, you know, I think the big image is, I think a lot of people who are either former Tories or never liked the Tories, like, Jacob Rees-Mogg is really like the symbol of, like, the last few years where, you know, cabinet appointments ended up scraping the barrel somewhat. Oh yeah, maybe this is just my view. Who can say? But so I do, you know, in the same way that IDS, I think, in Chingford for quite a long time was a Labour target, not really because it was entirely winnable, but because it was Ian Duncan Smith, etc. So I feel like Jacob Rees-Mogg as well, that strikes me as that's quite the price to win if you can get Jacob Rees-Mogg out of Parliament in Somerset.
Yeah, exactly. If it does happen, it will be a big headline of the night because of what it says about the fall of the Conservatives, because of what it says about the resurgence of the Lib Dems, because of what it says about the changing political geography of the country. Mm. And so that's why it's our constituency of the week.
Oh, no, don't do it again. Okay. Swear to God. I will leave, and that is not an empty threat.
One policy that polls particularly well with podcast hosts is liking and subscribing. Marie, do you like and subscribe?
That was so hammy, I hated it with a passion. Now, will we come back for 3 more episodes? I am no longer certain we will.
Oh, well, I was going to say, at least I didn't make the joke about taking a look at tomorrow's papers, but...
was great, though.
But apparently, no, I just can't win. But you know what would win, Marie?
Ah, go on, Joe.
Liking and subscribing.
Amazing. Okay, fine. Please like and subscribe to at least shut him up. You know, I'll have to do this for 3 more weeks.
And also leave a review, because I'm always interested in the qualitative element of these things.
No, same.
And it helps people find this podcast. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard today, then please tell your friends and all leading broadcasters so we can get a job on election night.
Oh, I'm actually fine. I will be spending my election drinking from the exit poll onwards. So do not book me. If you're a broadcaster listening to this, do not book me. But Joe.
I'm already booked. Actually, we'll have to take that bit out.